just a baby. Before I could speak, I would line up all my letter blocks alphabetically. Now it's my vocation and my passion to assign every decimal numbered shelf to every decimal numbered spine. I'm alive.
Well, welcome to the Library Show. This is Carrie Sigel here for the first time hosting. And with me in the studio is Principal Ben White. Ben, thank you for coming.
Thanks for having me, Carrie. Good morning.
This is my first time hosting. I may be a little nervous. Your first time being on the program, so if you're nervous, we'll just roll with it.
Yeah, and well, what people on the radio can't see is there's like 80 people who came to watch me today, so that's kind of all the prying eyes. They're outside the window looking in, so it is a little... Yeah, it's a little nerve-wracking.
Now, one thing I really like about you as a principal is you are a reader, and not all principals are readers, but you are clearly a reader, and I think that started when you were a young person living on an island. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, well, I was actually raised by a den of foxes on an island, and luckily for me, they were kind of higher-functioning canines, so they could write and whatnot. No, I grew up on Woodby Island, kind of on a farm, and growing up, we didn't have TV per my parents' choice. They believed that, you know, TV was not where we should be spending our time when we had time. And so we read. We'd read about an hour a night as a family. Everyone would go get a book. Everyone would read. And so I grew up from a young age just having reading be what you did. And out of that, you know, I kind of got hooked and read more and more and more. And now, you know, with three kids and the job, the thing that I frequently complain to my wife about is I don't have any time to read.
Yes, that is always a problem. What was your favorite book as a kid?
As a kid, probably the first book I read that I really, really enjoyed, and I read a lot of books. I really enjoyed like the Laura Ingalls Wilder series. I really enjoyed the Hardy Boy series. But the book that I read and have read many, many times and given to many people as a gift is Where the Red Fern Grows.
That's one of those books where the dog dies.
The dog does die.
Can you tell me a little bit about that book?
My interest in it or just kind of the story of the book?
Both.
Well, so the story of the book is a boy who's growing up in the Ozarks. He really, really wants to be become a raccoon hunter to get the raccoons and have money. And in order to do this, he has to have some coon hounds that can help him. And so the story is about his hard work selling worms as bait to fishermen to get up enough money. He then travels by himself without his parents' knowledge across the country to pick these dogs up, Old Dan and Little Ann, and comes back with them. And on the way, he has several adventures. And it's kind of a story of him entering adulthood as a kid and the adventures he gets into with these dogs, which subsequently involve his grandfather and his dad and the bond formed between he and the dogs. And it culminates with Little Ann and Old Dan getting in a fight with a mountain lion, which brings them to their demise. And the title of the book is based off of an old Indian belief that where there's true love, where when you die, a red fern will grow over your grave. And where he planted those dogs, years later when he returns, there's a red fern.
And why was that a favorite book? Why did that speak to you?
For many reasons. I've always been an avid dog lover. I love dogs, so that's probably what first initially interested me in that. And then I also love the outdoors. I love hunting. I love fishing. And that's essentially what the entire book is about. And it also was a very appropriate book for me at the time. I think I probably would have read it when I was 10 or 11. And some of the challenges that kid faced, I remember purely coincidentally, I had started chopping down a tree with my dad's machete just to do, and he discovered it. And said, you know, you've killed this tree now, and it's a really big tree. You should not have chopped it. I asked, you know, I did not give you permission. You should have my machete. And so my penance was to chop that entire tree down with that machete, which took me about a day and a half. I had blisters on my hands. They were bloody. But my dad said, you know, if you're going to start something, you finish it. And in that book that I happen to be reading at the same time, there's a scene where he has to chop down this mighty tree with an axe to get the raccoon out of it. And his hands are also bloody and calloused. I remember thinking, I'm just like that kid. I'm just like him. No raccoons jumped out of the tree, though. Yeah.
So what other books did you read on Woodby Island, and did your parents read books to you?
Yeah, my parents read books to both my brother and I. Obviously, that became less and less. What would frequently happen, though, is if one of the family members read something particularly funny or particularly good, we'd read it out loud. And a lot of time what would happen is we'd kind of sit around in our living room and read. And someone would start laughing, and then the family would be staring at them, and they'd continue laughing more, and then before long we would say, well, what is it? And about 50% of the time they'd read it, and everyone would, they'd just get blank stares and crickets, because he'd be like, I don't get it, because we hadn't read the book. And about half the time it was really funny. I think you asked me what other books I read?
Yeah, well, you were a young kid.
I can't even remember all the books I read. My mom, we'd always go every weekend to the library, and we'd check out books. And I remember to this day when I got my Whidbey Island Snow Isle Regional Library card, I was like, oh, I'm finally a man. You know, I was like 9 years old. And I just thought, oh, what a rites of passage. I can check out my own book. So anyways, listeners, you can tell I was super, super cool growing up. So once I had my library card, the library was kind of central to the schools. I'd go after school and return books and check books out. And I was always trying to get kind of the more like risque, violent type books. So my parents did believe in censorship. So a lot of the books I would bring home, they're like, we're not going to let you read this.
Did you have a place to hide books eventually that you
That was mainly home? For magazines, but I don't know that we want to get into that on this show.
Not at all. Not at all. So have you read yet to your children Where the Red Fern Grows?
No, we have not started Where the Red Fern Grows yet. Knowing both my sons, Nathan, who was 8, and Noah, who was 6, and then my daughter, Annie, who's almost 2, both my sons would find that a heart-wrenching story. Like it would be too sad for them at this point. We are, however, currently reading another fantastic book, Danny, Champion of the World. And I encourage any dads who like to read stories about fathers and sons and hunting. This is a great book. It's your kids will love it. You will love it. And it kind of brings up the opportunity to talk about some significant issues, because in the book, the father is teaching his son how to illegally poach pheasants. And so my boys have a lot of questions about, well, wait a second. The police say this isn't a good idea, but the daddy is doing it and he's letting his son do it. So isn't that a bad choice? And so we get to talk a lot about, you know, bad choices and good choices and, you know, do adults always do the right thing? So it really does open up some, I feel, kind of key conversations.
I read that book for the first time last year when it was a battle book, I believe. And what struck me is the relationship between the father and the son is very close, very special, a relationship that a lot of children are missing in their lives.
Yeah.
So I think that's one reason I find the book so appealing, and maybe that a lot of young people. What's the funniest part of the book so far?
The part that I've had to read a few times, and keep in mind, my sons are 8 and 6, is when the dad gets shot in the butt with the shotgun pellets as he's leaving the game farm after having poached. And his son has to pick out the lead BBs from his butt cheeks. And my boys think that's just hilarious, as the author, Roald Dahl, describes the scene of the father bent over and the son with tweezers and a bowl of hot water, and the father grimacing and flinching every time the son pulls a pellet out of his rear. I think secretly they're just waiting for me to get shot in the butt so they can do me the same favor.
I think one of the other things I found appealing, or would have found as a child, is the place where they live. Where Danny
right.
and his father live. I would, to this day, I would like to live in such a place. Maybe you can describe it.
Yeah, so they live in essentially what's described in the book as an old gypsy caravan. It's a covered wagon that they have done a little work to and made a one room with 2 beds and a small stove. But how it's described, you know, what makes any book, in my opinion, great is the details. How with words they paint a picture for us. And Roald Dahl does an excellent job of describing this caravan as the most warm, secure, best-smelling place where nothing negative or vile or bad has ever happened or will happen. And it kind of leaves you with the sense of, oh, even though that's essentially a covered wagon, it is a good home for the kid. The kid loves it. He has that sense and feeling of home that we wish all our young people had.
Now, when you moved into high school, I'm assuming that you had assigned reading. Do you remember any of that?
You know, I continued doing a lot of just my own reading in high school. And, you know, one of the things that I value even now as an adult, and probably more and more as I mature, is that reading is a part of my life. Because I have friends who don't read, and I really think it has kind of they're missing something. I mean, we all read every day for, you know, for work, whatever. But I mean reading for enjoyment and or information. One of the books that I had in high school, which really had a big impact on me, was Elie Wiesel's book Night. I read that, and I cannot recall if it was for a class or not, And for those of you who don't know, he is a Holocaust survivor, and he writes about being shipped to the concentration camps, losing his family, and the book even goes past that once he's out of the camps. And it was such a, it was one of those books that I hated to read, but I couldn't quit reading it because it kind of, you know, I think right now of what happened in France over the weekend, and it just, like that, it kind of speaks to the worst of humanity and what we are capable of doing to one another, which defies, I don't know, logic, common sense. It defies a lot of things. And so that book was very hard for me to read, but at the same time, it to this day, I've read that book several times. And one of the things that has stuck with me from that is the author's idea of we can't ever forget. We've got to know this happened because it will happen again. And the first time, you know, perhaps we didn't know. Perhaps we turned the blind eye. Perhaps there just wasn't enough proof as these allegations and rumors started. But I think a big thing he was driving at is we now know. We know we can do this sort of thing. We have to be on the watch for it.
A book I just finished was Devil's Arithmetic by Jane Yolen. I'm taking a children's literature class from Brigham Young University online. I have to read 65 books. And one of the required books is Devil's Arithmetic. It's about a girl, Hannah Stern. She's probably 13 or 14. She's going to a Passover Seder meal at her grandparents. And you can tell she's just tired of going to those meals. She's tired of what her grandfather does, what he speaks about. And she's chosen to answer the door. And a little bit of time travel happens. She opens the door for unexpected guests. And she times travel back to Nazi Germany. And she's on a shtetl. And her name there is, she has a different name there. It's Kaya. And she is a girl who's just recovered from a bout of cholera. Her parents have died when the Nazis come to the village and round up the entire village and take them to a concentration camp. And there she's with the girls of the village, including a girl named Rivka. And there's a sad end for most of the people, most of the characters in the story. And she actually does a very brave thing. She realizes that she's reconnecting and possibly going to time travel back to the future. And a guard comes up to a group of girls and says he's going to take three of them into the showers. And they know what that means. And she offers to go for a character named Rivka. And you don't hear anything more. You just realize that now she times travels back to the future. She's alive. And she realizes that her aunt at the Seder meal was Rivka.
Oh.
So she saves her aunt.
Right.
And the reference, I didn't know what Devil's Arithmetic meant, but it's mentioned twice in the book. And one is that every day you survive is 1 + 1 + 1. And then the other thought is that every time you survive, someone else didn't. So in your place.
Yeah, it's you know, that gives me the goosebumps just hearing you say that. And one of the things that Ilie Wiesel speaks of in the book Night is how there's a line in there, and I'm sure I won't do it justice, and I'm not quoting exactly, but he said, all of the best of us died. And his point was the best of the people there did things like that. They sacrificed themselves, essentially. They went without food when really there was so little food that they knew it was a death sentence. And it what didn't dawn on me on the first and maybe even second reading of that book was how underlying this horrible, terrible narrative of what took place is this idea that there was hope that remained, that people did survive, and that even in the worst of times, people showed their best self. And I really think that when we hear about things like that, that's almost what we should focus on. You know, we can't discount the atrocity. We can't discount the horribleness. But man, I kind of feel like one of the ways to fight that evil is to talk about the good.
I think one reason books are becoming more important on that topic, of that era, is that that generation is passing. We've had, since the time I've been in Blatchley, two Holocaust survivors come, but it's been 7 or 8 years. And I was saddened to learn a year or two ago that Klaus, I think his last name was Stern, passed away. So now when they talk about Holocaust survivor, they're often talking about children that were people that were children or babies,
right, right,
when they were in the camps, or children of survivors, that generation is passing away. Have you ever visited in Europe or other parts of the world?
I have. You know, like I said, growing up, I read a lot. And what struck me is so many of the stories that I read about took place not on Whidbey Island, not surprisingly. And the author's way of describing, you know, the way a meal tasted, or the way the city sounded, or the way the night out in the mountains slowly got chilled and he could watch frost appear. All of those things always, you know, I kept thinking, man, I got to go see this place. I got to go see this place. I got to go see this place. And fortunately for me, my father was an airline pilot growing up, and I was able to travel very inexpensively, essentially pay the tax on an airplane ticket. And so I've been able to go to Europe several times, across Africa a couple of times, around Southeast Asia, and just kind of pursue adventures. I never really had any real agenda in going to those places. I knew there was things I wanted to see, but really it was kind of like, well, I haven't been to this kind of part of the world. Let's go over there.
Had you read books about Africa before traveling there?
I had. I had read a lot of books, kind of in my interest in animals. I read a lot of the books that were written predominantly by British professional hunters in Africa that conducted safaris in like the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s. And they weren't, they may have been outstanding professional hunters. They were not necessarily outstanding authors. However, their stories were so incredible. You know, being over in Africa and hunting, and you know, being treated by lions or attacked by a buffalo, that I read a lot of those kinds of stories growing up. And so and also with my interest in animals, I watched, you know, every nature show. Once we did get a TV, that was one of the things I was allowed to watch, was like the BBC and Marty Stauffer and all those outdoor shows. So I watched a lot of shows in Africa. So I actually have traveled quite a bit.
No, I remember from times you've told stories at Blatchley that you traveled in east part of Africa, south part of Africa. I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Kenya many years ago, so we have something slightly in common there. But I remember a story you told about Madagascar, or an island off the coast of Madagascar. And we'll find a way to tie this back to books and writing, I'm sure. So well, could you tell that story?
Yeah, sure. One of the things that listeners should know is Carrie did charge me with finding my journals, because I couldn't always carry a book with me when I traveled, because a lot of what I did was on foot. And so I tried to be as light as possible. But I always kept a journal everywhere I went. And I did not dig them out this weekend, and I should have, because I could have regaled you with some of my, what I'm sure is outstanding teenage writing. But I think the story that you're referring to is I had the opportunity to go out to Madagascar, which we did, which was just phenomenal. This is when I was 18, so 21 years. How old am I? 21 years ago. And so it was just, I mean, it was different than anything I'd ever experienced. One of the things we had done is gotten a World Wildlife Federation map and located a small island off the coast of Madagascar, about 13 miles off the coast, that was ringed by a coral reef, uninhabited, no fresh water. And we thought, if we can get out to this island, we'll have a week of just unadulterated, just pure, pristine snorkeling. It'll be, you know, mind-blowing. That, just to get to the northern tip of the island, we had to leave the capital of Antananarivo and travel up toward the tip of the island. And that alone took us about 4 days to get up there, because they didn't have roads. We were on this thing called the Taxi Bruce, which was like a waking nightmare. Ended up staying the night when we finally arrived in a bordello, because that's the only place that rented rooms. Got infested by fleas. We were so tired, we passed out, woke up in the morning just covered in flea bites from, I hope they were fleas. We're going to go with that, in flea bites from head to foot. We then walked to this small village where they spoke only Malagasy or French, and I'm rusty in both of those languages. So through like kind of pictures on the sand, we illustrated to them, like, we want to go out to this small island called Nosihara and have you leave us for a week and come back and get us. You know, we drew like, you know, seven moons, seven suns, and they're like, oh, I mean, they seemed fine with what we were suggesting. I think they probably would be fine just dropping us off also and being like, oh, did you want to go get those guys? Because nobody's ever going to see them again. And so we went out there, and it was great for the first 2 days. And on the third day, we had brought all of our fresh water with us. We realized that five of our five-gallon jugs had leaks in them, and we were without water. And when we discovered it, we had maybe a gallon of fresh water left. We had 4 days left on the island. You know, it's 100 and some degrees. We're swimming in salt water. Just a side note, it was wonderful, wonderful, wonderful snorkeling. It was, we were able to dive down and catch cray, which are like a giant lobster, except they lack the front claws, which is fantastic knowledge when you're grabbing them. But there was a multitude of little tiny jellyfish, like there was some sort of spawn. So the entire time we were swimming, we were getting stung by these jellyfish. Not enough to actually hurt you, but enough to be like chronically itchy and inflamed all over. So that was just one plus. So long story short, two days later, we haven't had any water. Our, you know, our throats are starting to swell shut. Our lips are cracked. And we realize if they, you know, maybe we can survive the next day or so, but if they don't come back on the day they're supposed to come back, we're going to die. I mean, there was no fresh water anywhere. It's a small island. We didn't know any of the local, you know, plants well enough to be eating or knowing what to eat. We had no problem catching fish and stuff to eat, but the water was a real issue. So we took those empty jugs. We took a length of a branch, and we tied them on, and we realized, okay, if they don't come, we're going to have to swim back across to the mainland, which, you know, 13 miles sounds like a lot, but we figured we could kind of keep an eye on the tides, and we wouldn't, you know, we'd be buoyant, and it would take us, a day.
Go in with the tide.
Right. The problem is that's the most shark-infested waters in the world between, you know, the coast of Madagascar and Africa, and so we weren't sure if we were going to make it or not. But we figured, you know, maybe the sharks would leave us alone. We would for sure die of thirst.
What was happening to you at this point? Like, was your tongue swelling up?
Oh, yeah. No, our lips were cracked. Our tongues were swelling. We had constant, like, your body just hurts all over. Just your, and you know, it's because you're, like, all your joints have fluid in them, and that fluid is slowly being consumed. So it actually, you know, like, your bones and cartilage is rubbing. It's not doing what it should. You have just a really intense headache. You don't want to move. We pretty much just laid in the tent all day and would occasionally mutter words to each other like Slurpee or, you know, or lemonade.
But you also did some riding?
Yeah, not during that time. I was, didn't feel very good. Long story short, we did swim back across the channel. Luckily, we were able to grab a great white and he towed us to, no, I'm kidding. The morning that we were supposed to leave, and we were kind of like resigned to it, they came around the water, came around the corner in their little outrigger canoe and picked us up, and we were just so thrilled. Unfortunately, we had about a, you know, 2-hour paddle back. They had no water with them either, and they were cooking these eggs. And they had a little fire going in the wooden canoe, and they were cooking eggs, and they kept offering us eggs. And, like, the last thing we wanted was, like, you know, a dry, saliva-requiring egg. We couldn't even talk. And then when we got back to this little village, of course, we started pounding all the water we could, which we then instantly vomited because we hadn't eaten. And so that was almost just as bad, as that we could only take little tiny drinks of water at a time. And all you wanted to do was like hit a 7-Eleven and suck down the entire Slurpee machine.
Did you get some sympathy from the people that had come and picked you up?
You know, one of the things you learn when you travel is that in general, Americans are not tough. So, no, we didn't get any sympathy, and I think for them that was just kind of another day in paradise, so to speak, and they've all been there and had that happen, and you just kind of...
But then you journaled your many adventures when you felt better after the vomiting.
Right.
So, and you don't... what do you plan to do with your journals, and do you plan to share them with your children, and can you share them with your children at some point?
You know, it's funny, because I, just for the first time in years, I dug out all my old photographs, and I was shocked at how many of them I could not show to my kids. I was like, wow, I really was 18 when I was doing this. And same thing with the writings. You know, some of them are funny and candid, and some of them I will certainly let my kids read, but they'll need to be a little bit older.
Well, I'm going to talk about a book that I brought with me, and then I'm going to come back to you to ask you about some things about children and reading.
Okay, great,
so
great.
Maybe your children and middle school children.
Yeah.
One of the books that I started a long time ago at a friend's house I was dog sitting was Wool by, let me see what his name is, Hugh Howey. And it's a dystopian book set in the future. All of humanity, at least as far as the humanity we know, lives in a 144-story buried silo. And only the top floor is accessible to the outside world, which is a wasteland, a dusty wasteland. And the story starts out with the sheriff of the entire silo climbing up the stairs. And he's climbing up to this top floor where he can look out through a camera or a sensor. He can look out into the dusty, dark gray, red world. And what you don't know is that he's planning to declare that he wants to go outside, which is the tantamount to committing suicide, because once you've declared you want to go outside, you must go outside. And he's put in a cell. He's suited up. He's given some steel wool, and he's sent out into the world. And his one job when he goes out is to clean off the outside of the sensor so that the vision of the outside world is clearer to those people living in the silo. One thing you realize is that the silo seems to be a little worn. The treads on the spiral staircase that go up through the 144 floors, all the treading has been worn off. They depend on servers that have been operating for hundreds of years. You realize that in the future of this very well-described world that things are going to get tough and they're going to have to look to the outside. But that's as far as I've gotten. What's interesting about this story, and I think I'm going to pass it on to you when I'm done.
Okay.
I borrowed it from Brooke Schaefer's mom, who's Brooke's sitting here with us in the studio running the controls since I'm not really familiar with them yet. But the author totally published online through Amazon self-publishing. And he had such success that publishers started coming to him. And he did something unheard of for online publishers. He did sell the rights to his book, which is now published in a book form. But he retained the online rights. And just through his online publishing, he was pulling in thousands and thousands of dollars every day. He took what was just a short story and serialized it into a novel. And it's very compelling. He does a really good job of setting this world. You believe that there's this silo that's 144 stories and that these people live in this silo and that the world outside is uninhabitable. So that's the book I'm reading. But back to you, your children, what are their favorite books?
My oldest boy, Nathan, just about 7 days ago got his first dog, and he chose a standard poodle after much research, of over a year of research. So his favorite books, and he's got lots of them, are dog books right now. The other night, my wife went into bed to tuck him in, and he was laying in bed with a poodle on one arm, his headlamp on, and reading Care of Standard Poodles in the other. And so we thought that was pretty cute. And my youngest son, not youngest kid, Noah, his actually favorite book to read or to have read to him is the Children's Bible. He loves all the Bible stories, and he has lots of complex questions about, why was it okay for that small guy to kill that great big guy? You know, David and Goliath, and then we talk about...
Does he go back to the same stories?
Oh, yeah, well, the Bible that we have is, it's about once a month we complete it, and we've read it, 27 times now. So, yeah, and he will frequently say, oh, we left off right here, and he'll just pick whatever story it was.
So your story about your son's headlamp reminded me something about the Peace Corps. I lived in a three-room shack, and I did have kerosene lamps.
This was when you were in Kenya.
But mainly I depended on candlelight. I didn't like the kerosene lamps. They hurt my fingers to the fuel. And then the pressure lamps are so loud.
Right.
So I preferred one candle at night, and I would lie in bed with the candle in a bowl on my stomach with the book behind the candle, and I would read for hours.
Hoping not to burst into flame?
hoping not to burst into flame. Not knowledgeable about what the blankets were made of.
Right.
But I don't have the habit of falling asleep.
I was thinking about the book.
Oh, no, yeah. No. I'm pretty aware when I'm reading, and I don't fall asleep when I'm reading, but that's a memory I have of reading.
Right.
All those years of reading by candlelight.
I've got a real quick story about one candle, if I have time for it, in Madagascar.
You have a very quick time.
Okay, here's the synopsis. Madagascar again, giant cave full of giant bats, very dark, with a buddy. Very, very scared of spiders, going to the cave, and he screams like you could not believe, there's a spider, there's a spider! To which I reply, there's no spider, you can't see it, I can't see my hand in front of my face. We had one candle in this cave that our guide had, so we couldn't see anything. And he's like, I hear it. And I'm like, what do you mean you hear a spider? And I can hear him running back and forth, but there's nowhere to go. He's going to fall off like a precipice or run into a stalactite. Long story short, there was a spider, and we could hear it walking, and I did catch it. And as soon as I picked it up, he freaked out and tried to run out of the cave, and we had to go find him because he got lost in the dark.
Hey, we've only got about 30 seconds here. This has been KCAW, Sitka, Alaska, Raven Radio, but maybe you could take us out with the library song, Ben.
I would love to. Should I just start singing it?
Start singing
it. All right. Here we go. This is my first time singing the song. when I was just a baby, before I could speak, I would